Hi, friends. Welcome to the Full and Thriving podcast. I'm your host, Meg McCabe. And if you're here, it means you're ready for some aha moments that will inspire you to create a more vibrant, authentic life that's full of joyful moments, deeper connections, inner peace, and courageous action towards your dreams. Let's get started.
All right, my friends, tell me if you can relate to this. Have you ever met someone for the first time and then they looked at you kind of funny? And despite any evidence or facts, you somehow convince yourself that they hate you, or at least they're very mad at you? Have you ever felt frozen in a social situation because you didn't know what to say in fear of being judged or rejected? And finally, do you overanalyze the texts you send to people if they don't respond right away? Well, if you relate to anything of what I just said, today is your lucky day, because today I sit down with psychotherapist and mindfulness and anxiety coach, Charlene Gethins, who talks openly about her journey of healing her own social anxiety and, side note, how getting hit by a bus and then a car and surviving it helped her turn to mindfulness, which transformed her life. This is a wild interview and so full of helpful information that I know my audience will love. So sit tight and enjoy this episode of the show. Hello, Charlene. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well, thanks. How are you doing?
I am doing so great, and I'm so excited to talk to you today. Welcome to Full and Thriving.
I'm so happy to be here today. I'm really excited about some of the questions that you kind of let me know we're going to focus on.
Well, the second I, came across your work and you mentioned that you can help people transform their social anxiety, I was like, this has to happen. This woman needs to be a guest on the show. So I am so thrilled, because I know that there are many listeners in my audience who struggle with social anxiety. They're always telling lies to themselves, like, this person doesn't like me, or this person's mad at me. And I love the fact that today we're going to be talking about how you were able to transform your social anxiety into confidence. So let's just dive right in. Could you please tell me a little bit about your personal and professional background?
Sure. So my professional background is in the mental health field. So I had got my undergrad in psychology, and then I went off to a college program called Child and Youth Worker to work with kids and youth with mental health and behavioral issues. My social anxiety starts affecting my professional right there, because I didn't apply to grad school because I was like, oh, I won't get in.
So
I didn't even bother applying. So I went off to college. I graduated. I started working with kids. I was working in the school board. I was working in hospital settings, group homes. So I had kids with developmental delays. I had kids with mental health issues that I was working with. Trained in cognitive behavioral therapy, still dealing with a lot of social anxiety. And then this is where the juicy bit comes in. And then one day I went to go see a movie, and on my way home, I was hit by a bus while crossing the street.
Oh my gosh. That is, first of all, I'm so sorry that that happened to you. And what a scary moment. Are you shocked? How was that for you? What was that like?
So I have no memory of the accident. I vaguely remember bits of the night. I remember kind of getting ready to leave. And then next thing I know, it's like 2 weeks later, I'm in the hospital in the neurosurgery ward. I've had an emergency craniectomy. I have a traumatic brain injury because I was hit by a bus. The weird thing is, I don't remember any of it, but everyone's like, you never asked what happened. So I'm like, I feel like it's there somewhere, but it was 11 years ago and it hasn't surfaced as of yet. So
Wow. We'll
just keep that door closed. But I was hit by a bus, which is a bizarre statement to make, especially when you don't remember it happening, but I was hit by a bus. And because of the injury, the brain injury, the surgeries, the doctors were very much like, so the work that you were doing, you can't do anymore. Like, I was working with kids with autism. I was working with kids that when they would have meltdowns, they would act out, sometimes aggressively. And so they're like, yeah, you can't be doing this anymore. Like, you have to find a new career. They obviously don't tell you, here's your new career path, as they discharge you. But like, I was discharged from the hospital. They had removed this piece of my skull to reduce the pressure on my brain and sent me home. And with the plan of like, for 3 months, there was going to be nothing over this part of my brain, so the swelling could go down. And then they were going to put the bone back in, which they did. And, you know, then everything was supposed to be fine, which it wasn't. I ended up needing six months after the accident, 3 months after they put the bone back, I was back in the emergency room having another emergency craniectomy because the bone had become infected and needed to come out again.
Wow.
That time was out for a year. Now, you can imagine not having a bone over part of your brain is not a good thing. But because, like, well, your brain's exposed in a sense. Yeah. Like, I had hair, I had skin, like, you couldn't see it, but it's more vulnerable. Mm-hmm. But it also sort of deteriorates during that time. Mm-hmm. It gets better when the bone goes back, but like, during that time, like, there's so many things. Like, you're weaker, your balance is off, your head is misshapen. Your brain doesn't work the way that it used to. I mean, the brain injury also affects that, but like, there's a lot of things that aren't good about having the bone out, and it was out for a year.
Wow.
And I was experiencing complications, which is why I was out for so long. And it was during that time that my social worker, who I'd been working with from almost immediately after the accident, suggested, maybe you should start learning some mindfulness meditation. And I was like, I'm desperate. I will try anything. And so I did. I started learning it. And I just remember sitting on the couch in this room, this very room, being like, everybody needs to learn this and I need to teach this.
Mm.
And it took a while, but I got my new prosthesis. I also got my master's in counseling psychology because I'm a high achiever. So I did that. And then I trained to become a mindfulness-based stress reduction teacher. And on the 5-year anniversary of the day that I was hit by a bus, I officially launched the mindfulness journey, and the next day I was hit by a car.
What? Can you just stay away from all streets? And
yeah.
I'm so sorry to hear that. That's
yeah. Wow. So Monday, January 21st, 2013, I was hit by a bus. Monday, January 22nd, 2018, I was hit by a car. So Monday, January 23rd, 2023, which would have been the 10 and 5 year, I didn't go anywhere. I was like, I'm just going to stay home tonight. But like, I always say mindfulness like changed my life. It transformed so many things, but it also saved my life over the last few years because I've had so many surgeries and complications and anxiety around it. And that's the thing why I'm so passionate about mindfulness. It helped me to become more confident. It helped me to heal my social anxiety, but it also helped me to navigate like the really difficult, challenging things that life was throwing in my direction.
Wow. Wow. That is a remarkable story and also a tragic story. I cannot believe that you survived getting hit by a bus. You don't really think people can survive that.
Yeah. I mean, it was touch and go there for a while. Again, I don't know any of this stuff, but like, it was scary. They didn't know what, if anything. And then like, I did almost die from my injuries, which is what led to the first surgery. Mm. But like, you don't know. And the thing is, I'm still very much rebuilding from the first and the second and figuring things out. But that's what mindfulness helps, because it's all about learning how to be with the uncertainty of life. Mm-hmm. Because nobody really knows.
Mm-hmm.
Like, people say, you never know tomorrow you could be hit by a bus. Mm-hmm. I mean, it does happen, but you don't know. Nobody knows what tomorrow is going to bring. And somebody who's been through what I've been through, like, I've had 2 bone infections, I've had 10 surgeries, 2 accidents, like, it's a lot. But learning how to be with uncertainty has helped me to navigate that without so much anxiety, because I literally don't know. This could all happen again.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily the hit by bus part, but the infections and the surgeries could very much happen again. But I can choose to manage my anxiety, to not let it run the show, and to not constantly have that, but what if,
right,
in the back of my head.
Right. So that's really fascinating. So I really want to hone in on like this transformation here. So could you tell me a little bit about where your mindset was socially before you transformed? Like, what was your anxiety telling you? How were you behaving? What was it like to be you with social anxiety, whether it's before or after the crash? I just want to know kind of what your experience was like.
So I was always described as being shy, and shy and social anxiety kind of go together. You can have one without the other, but I was shy in that, like, I never talked. And I was so anxious about talking. I remember in grade 3, parent-teacher interview night, my teacher said to my parents, he was like, I can't grade her in, like, his, you know, participation. She never talks. Like, in grade 3, he's like, I can't get her. Like, he would try, and he would try to, like, you know, get me out of my shell, but, like, I just couldn't do it. And I always struggled so much with talking to people, friends, family members, like not my parents so much, but like if we were out with extended family, like cousins and stuff, like I wouldn't know what to say. Like, how do you just talk to people? And I would see people who could just like talk. And I always just was kind of like, how? I didn't think it was possible. And I know that sounds so like, what do you mean? But like for me, it was such a hindrance that like to see someone just confidently walk into a room and like approach was so like, I would have loved to have been that person, didn't know that I could be, didn't think it was possible. Like, there was a part of me that's like, well, this is just who I am. This is just how things are, because you don't know what you don't know.
Right.
And I didn't know that I could change, even with the background in mental health. Like, I knew strategies and stuff, but I couldn't get that piece of the puzzle. Mm-hmm. There was something I was missing, and I couldn't figure it out. My friend, my best friend, tells me this story. She worked in a field when she met different people from like college and stuff, and they would hang out together, and she would invite me because we were best friends and roomies for a period of time. So I would go out with them. And because I was shy, I barely talked to them. But like, I would consider them like a friend, but like, I just really had a hard time talking to people. And so like, they would invite me to things with her. Like, if they were having a party, I'd be invited and we'd hang out together. And I thought we were kind of friends, but like, not like close friends. Like, I didn't speak to them outside of this group. But they invited me once to hang out when she couldn't come. And I said yes, and I went, and we hung out. And I very clearly remember being with them, like sitting at a table and having moments and being like, should I say this? And what if I say this? And will they think this is stupid? Like the constant refrain in my head over like overthinking and all the like, what if I say this? What if I say that? And after the fact, they spoke to her and they were like, you know, we didn't think that she was going to come. We didn't think she liked us. And she was like, no, she's just really shy.
Wow.
That's just Charlene. She's just really shy. They were surprised that I came, and like I came and I talked, because like I don't talk much. I would mostly just kind of stand there. Like the same friend had to speak to waiters on my behalf before. Like it was debilitating. And when you live it, you know it, but you don't really know the difference until like now on the other side. I'm like, wow, I can do these things that I couldn't do before, which is wonderful, but like, it's bizarre how like, oh, there is the solution. There is a way to get out of this.
Right. Wow. Could you tell me a little bit about what stopped you from talking? Was it a fear of being judged? Was it?
Yeah,
it was. Was that mainly it?
It was this intense fear. Like, what if I say something stupid? And like, I was bullied by people, and like, my sister had a louder personality than I did, so she kind of always talked for me. Like, people would talk for me, so I didn't need to talk. But I was too scared to talk. Like, if my mom was talking to somebody and wanted to get her attention, like, I would try to silently communicate. That's not like, people don't hear that. But like, I would try to like, you know, telepathically communicate to people, like, come and talk to me, as opposed to going over to speak to them. Yeah. And this is why, like, in hindsight, I'm like, oh, this is anxiety. I was so scared that even like sitting at home, like back in the 90s, when we didn't have cell phones and could text people or stalk them on social media, like the idea of talking to the guy that I had a crush on was so like racing thoughts, sweaty palms, like my heart would be racing and I'd be sitting in my bedroom. In the 90s, it's not exactly as accessible to speak to people as it is now. Like I'd have to look them up in the phone book and then call. And that was never going to happen because I couldn't even call to order a pizza. Like I knew this wasn't going to happen, but I would still have the physiological reaction of like, I'm going to speak to this guy. He's not here. I'm not at any danger of actually speaking to him. But like my body didn't know that.
Yeah. So you had a lot of those physical symptoms too, along with those thoughts. So thank you for sharing all of that. I'm sure it's so relatable to the listeners right now. How did getting hit by the bus impact this part of you? And I'm curious about how you were able to eventually start transforming.
So in some ways, it made everything worse because now I had a whole new series of anxious thoughts to deal with on top of what I was already experiencing. But then, as I shared, like the bone was out for a significant period of time, like several times, and I looked different. And for somebody with insecurity, with anxiety, and I was self-conscious of how I looked prior to the accident. Like if I had a zit on my chin, I would be so self-conscious that everybody's staring at it, right? And nobody is. I realize this now, but at the time, like I'd be so self-conscious and uncomfortable that, oh my gosh, I have the zit on my chin and it's so big. And now my head is misshapen.
Mm-hmm.
And there were several people, not everybody, but a lot of people refused to look at me and not like communicating this to me, but like when somebody's talking to you, but they're not looking at you and you can see it. A friend came to visit and she brought her husband who I didn't know, but he like the whole time was visibly uncomfortable and like wouldn't look at me. And like, I could feel this. And so then it's like, oh yeah, like I do look funny. And like family members were really uncomfortable, but also like they saw and knew stuff that like I wasn't privy to because I was on a lot of drugs, but they saw things. And so they knew things, but then also with the bone, like they couldn't look at me. It made everything so much more uncomfortable for them. And so then I was uncomfortable. And then, you know, there's all like this unjustified sense of guilt around this idea that like what I've put everybody through, like there were so many emotions and so many things. And it was just like hard to be out and about. And like, again, my head was very much misshapen. When the bone infection happened, I ended up with a PICC line, which is like they stick the IV like into like your heart. I carried a fanny pack of meds around with me. I didn't leave the house a lot because, again, I was vulnerable, but a few times I would and people would stare. It's never the kids. It's always adults. Like I went to Walmart. We went to do some shopping and people were just staring at me because like I had a hat on to kind of hide things, but I had the PICC line and I had this fanny pack and it was the summer. So you could kind of see it. One woman approached me in the parking lot, wishing me well, which was nice, which is preferable to just staring. But like I knew I look funny.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the anxiety of just being out in public because I was a falls risk and like everything, it was just, it was a lot.
Yeah. That sounds like it really heightened the anxiety. You became extra self-conscious about like, you weren't just self-conscious about what you spoke and talked about anymore. It was like more self-consciousness about your appearance, looking abnormal compared to everyone else. I totally could see how it would make things even worse. So yeah. What was the point where you realized it was time to heal and start kind of working on your social anxiety?
So it was after the bone got infected. I had been working with a social worker for months at that point. We had thought that the procedure was going to happen around Christmas, and then it didn't. And I just basically kind of fell apart. I ended up going on an antidepressant for a while, We had no idea when this next surgery was going to happen. Everything was so up in the air. And I don't know what's coming next. And everything that could go wrong has kind of gone wrong already. Right. And so she was like, look, this might help. I was desperate. And so I said, sure. And so I started that in April and started my master's at the same time. But I knew something had to go. Like almost immediately after the accident, like shortly after I was discharged, I was like, I need a social worker. Like I knew because of my background, hey, this is going to be a lot. I'm going to need someone's assistance through this. My social worker is fantastic. I still work with her today. And so when she recommended this, I trusted
it. This is the mindfulness?
Yeah, she recommended learning mindfulness, and in particular, the mindfulness-based stress reduction program. And so it's an 8-week program. I was able to do it individually. It's normally done in a group. The woman who taught me, Jaysa, she had also been in a traumatic accident, so that also helped. Like, so the two of us kind of bonded. We're still friends today. And it was just starting to learn how to sit with our thoughts.
Mm.
So we would meditate and I would do these practices. And it helped a little, but I knew I needed to teach this. And it was when I underwent the training to be a teacher that the real shifts happened because I was doing the work like 12 hours a day for a week at a time. Like I was meditating constantly. My mom would accompany me because it was so soon after the accident. I had to go to the States from Toronto to do this. And I remember it was the second trip. So I was on my way through the program. We were on this Jungle River cruise in Florida at the end of my training. And they had these great big picnic style tables where you'd sit with complete strangers. And I turned to the woman next to me and I struck up a conversation. And my mom was like, I almost fell off the chair. Who is this woman? And like, even on the trips, like I would talk about being shy and people were like, if you hadn't said that you were shy, I would never have guessed it. And I was like, I know, like, but I was.
Mm.
Like I could talk to people. Prior to this, I wouldn't sign up for podcasts. Like I wouldn't be here talking. I talk so much more than I ever used to. Like I joke that people I went to school with probably don't know what my voice sounded like. Like they knew me because I used to Irish dance as a kid. So they knew me as the Irish dancer. But like, I bet they don't even know what my voice sounds like because I never spoke. And now I never shut
up. Oh my gosh. So I was an Irish dancer too. So that's funny. I sucked at that, but it's a different story. So mindfulness, I need you to break it down for me a little bit. You mentioned like you took your training and suddenly like you started talking to people. What was in between that though? Like what about mindfulness made you start breaking out of your shell?
So with mindfulness, we spend a lot of time meditating. And when you meditate and you sit and you pay attention to your thoughts, and we do it with this attitude of kindness, curiosity, and non-judgment. So Jon Kabat-Zinn created the mindfulness-based stress reduction program. He's written a ton of books. He speaks often about it. He's described mindfulness as paying attention to the reality of the present moment with an attitude of kindness, curiosity, and non-judgment.
Mm.
And it's that, and it's this that I got from my time as a therapist from dialectical behavior therapy or DBT, reality acceptance, like they go hand in hand. This, I don't have to like the reality of this moment to accept the reality of this moment, to be in the reality of this moment. And that's where a lot of the big shift came in. I don't have to like this to be in it because there's a lot of moments I didn't like. And it's not to say I'm never uncomfortable in social encounters. I am, but I can tolerate it. Mm-hmm. It doesn't send me into distress like it used to. I still get nervous. I still get in my head, but I notice it faster. Oh, you're in your head again.
Mm-hmm.
And this idea that like the thoughts that we have are just thoughts. They're not facts. They feel like they're facts because they always come with these big, strong emotions. But they're just thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
Like I can think, oh, I'm just going to use you as an example. Oh, Meg doesn't like me because of the way that like she's, you know, she's looking at me right now. But like, those aren't facts.
Right.
Those are thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
And that have nothing to do with facts at all. I had gone to a retreat after learning mindfulness, starting my business. Like this is to show how it still shows up. I had met a woman there. We started talking and I walked away from the conversation thinking, this woman does not like me. And I was okay with it because, like, whatever, we didn't need to be besties. But I had signed up to have like a consult call with her. And on the call, she said to me, she was so glad that I had booked this call because she wanted to connect with me because she wanted to work together. And I'm thinking in my head, and I thought she didn't like me. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes the work is after the fact. And I was like, right, I thought that because of like the look on her face, the way she was standing. But like also, this is day three of a retreat that she spoke at. Like, she was probably tired.
Right.
And being tired, she would look exactly the same way as someone who I'm thinking, oh, they don't like me. I thought like, oh, she was bored. That's one of my things that the work has led me to recognize, that I think I'm boring. So I'm always thinking that other people think I'm boring. And it's like, oh no, here it comes again. Because I was shy and quiet and I would read and people are like, reading is boring. So then I'm like, oh, I'm boring. And then it shows up in these moments. This is like, the work is constant. Like, oh, here it is again. Oh, right. That one time that guy on a date said that this was boring. And now I'm like 2 years later thinking, oh, this person thinks I'm boring. And it's like, no, these are thoughts.
So I feel like a lot of social anxiety is just jumping to conclusions about what people think about you and how they're feeling. And one thing that I like that you pointed out was that you hadn't put this woman at the conference into context the first time you saw her. Like, you just assumed her demeanor, the way she was behaving, was because she didn't like you. But contextually, after practicing mindfulness, you were able to be like, oh, she just presented for 3 days. She was hosting this conference. She was probably really exhausted. And this was not a personal issue with me.
Yeah. And I personalized everything. I was an overthinker, like not in this like egotistical, everyone's thinking about me kind of a way, but anxiety makes you think, oh, everybody's thinking and judging me. Mm-hmm. And they're not. Schitt's Creek is one of my favorite shows. There's an episode where David is going to get his driving test and he's really anxious about it. And Alexis says to him, people aren't thinking about you the way that you think they're thinking about you. And that's what mindfulness helped me to realize. Oh, this isn't a thing. Because I know that there are moments where I'm in my head about whatever, like with the friends who thought I didn't like them. And however I'm presenting, they're interpreting it one way, which isn't correct. Mm-hmm. And so creating that space, because mindfulness helps you, we talk about it, I call it the window of choice. It helps you to recognize that there's a space between the situation and how you can choose to respond. And I can recognize that there are alternative interpretations to a situation. Mm-hmm. And so when I notice my anxiety is telling me this is the answer, and then I can pause and be like, but there's also other possibilities. Mm-hmm. Like even take signing up to be on this podcast. You posted in the group. I responded. I filled out the form and it took a while to hear response. And a while is a judgment. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, because it's an interpretation of time, because 5 minutes can feel like 5 years when you're waiting for something, right? So it's not that like you took forever, you didn't, but like I didn't hear instantaneously. And so anxiety can be like, oh, she doesn't want me on her show. And maybe you didn't, but obviously I'm here if you did. But like, initially I'm like, oh, I guess she doesn't want me on her show. But without the emotional attachment that would have come before mindfulness, but you did reach out, clearly. But then I have the capacity and the bandwidth to be like, well, right, I'm pretty sure I'm not the only one that applied. So she has to go through the applications. And then like, you know, maybe the phone rang. Maybe she went to get something to eat. Maybe, you know, she worked. Like, that's what the space allows you to do, to be like, you know, there's more than one answer to this. Like, there's all these different possibilities. And it gets you to like, oh yeah, it could be lots of things. Because also, I don't respond to everything instantaneously. So just because something hasn't happened yet doesn't mean that like you're not going to hear. And then obviously I did. But like, this is where it shows up all the time. Like even still, I'm managing it constantly. I recognize when my anxiety is like, oh no. It's like, actually, is this the thing? Or is this your previous experience, your anxiety and your thoughts and showing up. And it's usually like, it's just my thoughts. But like, because it is.
Well, first of all, I appreciate you acknowledging that mindfulness creates this space where you can recognize your story that you're telling yourself might not be the only story, right? Mm-hmm. And that there are other options. I'm curious, for people who are listening, who are stuck in social anxiety, what other tips do you have for people to start challenging this in their own life? Like, how can they apply this or do this on their own?
There are two, and they're skills. They're mental health, emotion regulation, distress tolerance skills from my time as a therapist. One is called the STOP practice, and it's an acronym for STOP. So the S is to stop. Like when you're in the situation and your thoughts start to race and your heart's beating, you stop. Stop what you're doing. Stop talking. Stop everything. And then you T, you take a break, you take a breath, because when we breathe, we can regulate our nervous system because mm-hmm. it's racing and we want it to calm down, because when it's calmer, then we can think clearer. So we take a breath. And then the O is to observe. And in that O, we're noticing, what am I thinking? What am I feeling? How's it showing up in my body? But we're also noticing and observing the situation. Where am I? Who am I with? What do I see on the other person's face, their body language? What are the words that they are saying? And noticing, what is my interpretation of the words that they are saying? Because they might be very different. And then the P is to proceed mindfully from that moment after taking in all this facts. And we do it factually. It's Charlene's arms are crossed. It's not Charlene's arms are crossed and that means she's angry at me. No, it's Charlene's arms are crossed. Mm-hmm. Like, it's breaking it down to, what can I factually, scientifically describe? Not adding in our thoughts and our interpretations, just the facts. So the STOP practice and checking the facts kind of go together. It's always checking the facts. What do I know in this situation? My thoughts aren't facts. What are the facts? My emotions aren't facts. What are the facts? They provide information to me. I'm having this thought because I'm having this emotion because this reminds me of this, or this insecurity is showing up. But thoughts and emotions are not facts. So what are the facts? I'm feeling anxious right now. I'm noticing that my hands are a little sweaty. My thoughts are racing. My heart is pounding. I'm sitting in a room full of complete strangers. I have to walk up and talk to somebody, and I don't know how to do that. But when we breathe, we have the ability to, you know, calm down a little bit, and then we can observe, look around the room, and see who in this, like, say, networking event, who looks friendly. Which group of people looks like I can approach them and join in? Because body language tips us off. If they're super tight together and there's no space, then maybe I don't pick that group unless I actually know somebody in it that can kind of get me in. A group that's a bit more spread out, that seems like they're smiling, they're laughing, it looks a bit friendlier, so maybe I can approach that group. Or maybe I'd be more comfortable approaching that other socially anxious person who's sitting on the couch, not talking to anybody, right? I'm observing and I'm noticing and I'm proceeding mindfully. I'm taking all these facts and making a choice. I recently attended a networking event. I hadn't been anywhere since 2020, really, like in these kinds of situations because of health stuff. And I walked in there and another skill I teach is called coping ahead. So I was like, I can leave after 15 minutes if it feels too much. I don't have to stay the whole time. I can always just leave. I didn't know if I was going to know anybody there. I suspected a friend might be there, but I didn't know. And I didn't reach out to ask, which socially anxious Charlene would have ensured that she knew somebody. But I was like, no, she's there. It's okay. She's not. She's not. And I walked in and one of the organizers was there to greet people. So that kind of helped put me at ease a little bit. There wasn't too many people, so it felt kind of possible to find someone to talk to. My friend was there. So I was like, well, great. Now I have a thing. But like, you start small. Oh, this person standing in line beside me waiting for a drink. I can talk to this person.
I really appreciate the idea of giving yourself a moment to observe the room. And I like the context of a networking event, because it's very relatable, right? It's like those are the events you're almost there to meet people and socialize and people you don't know and that you might not be comfortable with.
Yeah.
So looking around the room and perceiving or seeing body, observing body language and thinking about the context too, like, you know, this person sitting alone, they're at a networking event. They want me to talk to them, right?
Yeah.
I think I was at a networking event the other day and I was alone and everyone got up to talk to each other. We just had this speaker and I was feeling really shy. I did not go out and talk to anyone. Everyone settled into groups and I just saw this one other person sitting by themselves and I was like, I'm just going to talk to her. And we ended up clicking immediately, almost because we were just happy that there we had started a conversation, right? So it's an interesting place to practice your mindfulness.
Yeah. And when I first started networking, I would go with a friend. Like my friend was like, come, let's go. You need to do this. And I was like, no. But like I knew it was important. Like we know that networking is important. So I would go with this friend. They're very good at like, have you met Charlene? And then like leaving. So like that you're forced to talk to people. So that like got me in the door of networking. But I made this commitment to go on my own. Like I've traveled to conferences where I didn't know anybody in the room. I might like through Instagram, but you don't really know someone. And I would go and I would show up and I would talk to people. But it takes time, it takes work and it takes practice. Like it's not like two meditations and I'm done. Like I'm still very much doing the work every day. And I've been teaching since 2018. And there are still moments where I'm like, oh shoot. Here's my social anxiety again. Like I forgot because it happened.
Right, right. So how would you describe a person who is confident socially? What is their mindset going into situations like that?
So previously, I assumed that they never had anxiety and that they, because they were so confident, right? But now, because people have called me confident, I realized that oh no, they still experience what I'm experiencing. They just do it anyways.
Right. That's so true. Cause I'm always very outgoing and I'm pretty confident. And no one would ever describe me as introverted or shy. But I have moments like I just shared where I'm feeling really shy and I almost just have to take that leap, like jump over the hump in a way and be like, all right, like, let's start this conversation. Let's get it rolling. Because once you're warmed up, it's a lot easier to keep things going, at least from my experience.
Yeah. And I do remember as an adult, when I would go to things and I would feel anxious and I'd have a glass of wine and it made me a little chattier. And so it made things a little easier. And so then we write the story of I need a little bit of alcohol, not like drunk, but like a glass of wine to take the edge off. And then I can speak to people. But here's the thing, the glass of wine didn't change me. Like it didn't give me, it wasn't like a cup of confidence. I'm still the same person before the glass of wine or after, but I felt more comfortable and at ease because a few things, like now I have something in my hands. I have something that I can do. Like if I'm feeling uncomfortable, I can take a sip. I can go to the bar and get another drink. I can go to the bathroom. Like I can use it as a tool to navigate. And I've talked about this in one of my Instagram reel around it. I was going to a party, hadn't been around people in a few years. I was uncomfortable because like they knew what I'd been through, but like I wasn't really like wanting to talk about it. And I walked into the room and was like looking for my friends. And I was like, I'm going to go to the bar because I had to cross the whole room so I'd be able to find them to go to the bar to get a drink. And I have something in my hands. And when your hands are busy, for me, my hands are busy. They're doing something. My mind is a bit calmer.
Interesting. So have you discovered things outside of grabbing a drink that help with you in that moment?
Yeah. Like, so when I'm anxious for anything, I could like play with Lego or build a puzzle, or I like to bake. Like, and so that, well, like not the social anxiety, but the other anxiety shows up, I bake. But I recall from prior to mindfulness, you would want me at your parties because when I get introverted and anxious, I go and I do your dishes. I tidy up. Oh, the pizza box is empty. So let me go throw this in the garbage. Oh, the chips need to be refilled. Like, I'm busy because I feel like I'm still a part of the party, but I'm managing my anxiety without like hiding in the corner. It's actually a skill.
Interesting.
That like now, because I teach this stuff, I recognize, oh, I was doing this without realizing it. But for me, I was escaping having to speak to people by doing something while still being in the party. And then when I started to relax a bit more and calm down, I could go back to talking to people. Like there are things, and I teach a lot of this stuff in my group coaching programs. Like there are a lot of little things that we don't think about, but these are skillful ways to navigate anxiety.
Wow. Okay.
And it's important to have them all in your back pocket so you can pull them out. Because as I said, sometimes I get anxious. And so I might do a breathing practice. Nobody knows I'm doing a breathing practice because I'm not sitting with my legs crossed on the floor of a party with my eyes closed meditating, but I'm doing a breathing practice.
So what you're saying is not to be go escape and do dishes the whole time, but if you need to regulate, you can go find something to do for a little bit and come back when you're feeling better. That's how I am too. Sometimes I have to take a step out and like call my sister for like 5 minutes or something like that and then go back in to the setting. So I like seeing that as a skill of mindfulness because you're aware the anxiety is a little up. You want to cope in some sort of way in order to continue socializing and, you know, being back in the present moment. I think that's great advice. So as we wrap up the show, a final question I want to ask you is, like, what wisdom do you have for someone who is a little socially anxious and want to transform more into a confident person?
I guess the biggest thing is that if you want to do it, like, it is possible. It does involve work. Like, calling it work makes it sound a lot harder than it is.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a process. And it takes time. And it's, like, it's a meditation practice, but it's also like informal meditation practices. Like, it's a practice. It's something I do every day. I am doing it right now. Like, I am not thinking about what's coming next or, oh my gosh, I said something stupid earlier. I'm here now in this moment with you talking to Meg and to whoever's listening. And that is a huge shift because I used to be talking to you, but in my head, I was like, oh my God, that was so stupid. What were you thinking? And like, I've been able to calm this down. It still shows up. Like if it shows up again, it's not that I'm terrible at mindfulness and I can't do the work. It's that I'm still doing the work. Jon Kabat-Zinn has been teaching this for like 50 years. He's still doing the work. Mm. Like it's not like I've meditated for 8 weeks and now I'm cured. No, it's not a cure. It's a method. It's a skill. It's a toolkit. It's, I have the stuff in my pocket all the time that I can pull out and I can recognize when I need it and then I can use it. Some of the stuff that I talked about here seems so simple and it is in theory. It's harder in practice, but with practice, you get better. Mm-hmm. I'll never be perfect. But the stuff that I can do now, like I have my own podcast and I have an episode that's Shy Charlene could never do most of the things that I do now. Like, oh, I don't have to get that, but my phone's ringing. There was like clothes. I would wear like muted colors because I didn't want to stand out. And now like I'm usually in the brightest outfit. Ordering things in a restaurant. Like I have intolerances and so even just being like, hey, what are your gluten-free options? Doesn't seem like a big thing, but it is. At that retreat I referenced earlier with the woman who I thought didn't like me, on the third day I was sitting with somebody new and we were having breakfast and I ordered an almond milk latte. Didn't think anything of it. The waiter left and the woman sitting next to me turned to me and said, wow, you ordered that so confidently. And I was like, it was just a coffee, right? But I had asked day one if they had almond milk to start. And she said to me, she said, I can't do dairy either. So I usually just order it black because I'm too like nervous to ask, hey, do you have almond milk? So she'll just order a black coffee. And I the shy person who couldn't speak to people, who like had to get my friend to send my steak back because it wasn't cooked well enough, was like, hey, do you have almond milk latte? Can I get an almond milk latte? Like, it's not a thing anymore. And everything was a thing. But it didn't go from, I started meditating today and now it's no longer a thing. Like, we're talking years. And it's still, I have moments where like, well, that was dumb. And then I'm like, all right, but you're also never going to see them again. So who cares? Right? Like, I'm constantly doing the work, the inner work, the proceeding mindfully after the fact, that like, okay, well, this happened and it's okay. It's not the end of the world. Right? It helps.
Yes. Yes. I can see that. I think it's a really helpful reminder just to let people know that even after you have become a more confident person, you're still going to have those moments where you're checking yourself. You have to implement the mindfulness, and that's okay. It doesn't make you a less confident person. It sounds like an evolving part of who you are that might need work continuously. Yeah. So I guess with that, I just want to say, Charlene, thank you so much for joining me on the show today. I think the listeners have learned quite a lot, and thank you for sharing your story with, you know, everything that you've been through. It's just amazing to see how you've transformed as a human, and it's really inspiring. I'm just very grateful. And how can people find your work if they feel connected to what you said today?
You can find me on Instagram at The Mindfulness Journey. I have group coaching programs. I have one on social anxiety for entrepreneurs that's starting in May.
Ooh, exciting.
You can find out information about that at themindfulnessjourney.com/social anxiety. Right now it's just a waitlist page, but it's coming soon. And I just teach this stuff everywhere. My podcast, Calm Amidst the Chaos, like I talk about this stuff there. Talk about it on Instagram. Like, as I said, I never shut up. I can talk for hours, which is bizarre for someone who like never talks. This is the work. And this is like getting out of your head and getting into your life. This is what this looks like. And yeah, doing this work has been so impactful. So as I said, I teach the programs, the group coaching. You can find me at The Mindfulness Journey.
Amazing. Well, thank you, Charlene. I hope you have a beautiful rest of your day.
Thank you so much for having me on. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah, totally was.
All right, that concludes this week's episode of the Full and Thriving Podcast. Thank you so much for taking the time to listen to this episode of the show. When you have a moment, please head on over to Instagram and follow my recovery coaching account at Meg_McCabe. To stay up to date on everything I'm doing in recovery land. And if you're feeling extra inspired, please send me a direct message to let me know how this podcast has impacted your life. I'd love to hear your feedback. Thanks again for listening, and I'll see you next week.